you've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, Tamara here. So glad you are with me today. Today's interview goes over three critical phases of innovation. Startup, scale up, screw up. No, you heard that right. The third one is a little bit surprising, but we're going to go into it. Now, before we break those down, I have an announcement to make. Woo! We have added our second day of interviews to the rotation. Woohoo! Now, you're not just going to get these incredible interviews on Tuesday, you will get them on Thursdays as well. They'll be full of innovation and insights and action. You asked over and over again. I'm sorry it took us so long, but we did answer. Two doses of innovation a week. Can you handle it? I think so. Now, for today's dose of innovation with Jürgen Appelo. You might recognize the name as we've had him on before, and he's a pretty well-known person in the kind of change management and agile field. He released his second book, Startup, Scale Up, Screw Up. Couldn't resist learning more about that. He's going to break those down for us. I think it's not what you think it is. It wasn't what I thought it was, that's for sure. He also talks about needing fewer managers, not more. Love that idea. And so many other parts around innovation. Okay, here we go. Jürgen, it's so good to talk to you again. I'm really looking forward to catching up and hearing what you're up to.
Oh, thank you, Tamara. It's great being here again.
Well, I don't think I asked you this question last time, so just to get to know you further, what's your first memory of being innovative?
My first memory, well, gosh, I define in being innovative as doing something creative that also adds value for someone else that they're willing to pay for. I've been very creative as a kid, of course, but I never really sold any of my drawings. But the first time I got paid for something creative that I did, I think that was when I was about 18, 19 years old, when I created my own bookkeeping system, because I was very much into bookkeeping. I like adding up numbers, specifically when it was about money. And I made my own bookkeeping system, and I actually sold that to a very few number of customers, to a handful of customers or something. But I was very, very proud of it. I think I worked like 1.5, 2 years on it, and I had 10 customers that barely paid for the sandwiches, but they were the first customers in my life, I think.
What I love most about that story is you saying, I loved bookkeeping as a kid. I just don't think you hear that very often.
No, I can be weird every now and then, yeah.
That's awesome. I love it. It's just so, that's so. And how did, just random question, but how did you discover you had a love for that? Because that's not something, at least from my perspective, as a kid, I don't remember having any exposure to until later in life.
Yeah, well, I became part of, well, it was my, when I joined the Students' Society, and I was asked to become part of the board. There was only one position that I was interested in, that was the treasurer of the board, because that sounded interesting to me, being responsible for the money. And then I got interested in debit and credit and how that all worked. And I read some books and everything, and I thought, oh, that's easy. I can write a program for that.
Oh my God, I love it. All right. I could go on and on about the fact that you did bookkeeping as a kid, but we will launch forward into what we're here to talk about today, which is really business innovation. So I wanted to start with something I read on your website on the What I Do section, which took me a little bit by surprise the way you said it. So I wanted to ask you about it. It says, helping people to introduce better management with fewer managers. Talk to me a little bit about what you mean by better and why fewer. Yeah. Talk to me about
this. Yeah, sure. My first book was called Management 3.0, And that was all about, some would refer to it maybe as servant leadership and other terms like that. I'm not the only one coming to the conclusion that command and control style management does not work anymore in the 21st century in most organizations. And I have particularly a focus on agile, business agility, lean, and things like that. So I carved out my niche in the agile community worldwide, and there was a big need for better management in agile organizations. And usually companies were suffering from command and control kind of structures where people just had to follow the instructions of management. The rule or the principles in the agile world is to have self-organizing teams. They can self-manage to a large extent, and then the role of the manager becomes very different. You set the boundaries of the system, you give them a vision, a mission, and then let them work it out together. Which works much better with intelligent professionals. And if you do that, well, the logical conclusion is that you need fewer managers because to some extent people are managing each other. And they still need managers. You still need managers because the constraints need to be set on the self-organizing teams. But I am happy that I practiced this myself. I practiced what I preached, of course, at the time. And ultimately, I had indirectly a span of control was for 100 software developers. And I noticed that I had time on my hands to do some other stuff, and it was awesome, and things were actually going better than they were before after I introduced a more agile form of management. So yeah, the management is better with self-organizing teams, giving them more freedom to self-organize and self-manage, and you need fewer managers at the same time.
It's so interesting to me, and part of the reason I picked up on that was the management level at a lot of organizations, regardless of agile, feels very bloated. You know, like yes. There's this, but like, you know, instead of being a pyramid, there's like a bubble in the middle at the management level. I'm often very surprised or I guess a little bit befuddled because I can't figure out what half of them do.
Well, the problem is that in many organizations, that's the only way to make progress, to make a career, is to move up the hierarchy. That's the only way to get paid more. And that's why management positions are invented or created just to enable people to earn more money and to have them give them a feeling of making progress. While there's no actual need in terms of the amount of work, there's just work created, basically. So the solution is, and that is what plenty of software companies and other kinds of companies have already discovered, is to give alternative career paths where it is possible to earn more without becoming a manager. And this is perfectly normal in more forward-thinking companies such as Google and Facebook, et cetera, where the best engineers can make tons of money and they don't end up being managers because the companies understand that once you make them a manager, you destroy them, basically. Right. Because that's not what they're good at. They just want to be great engineers and they have to be paid for that accordingly. So there's entirely different career paths possible. And then you need fewer managers.
That really, Jürgen, that's really for us on Launch Street, a really profound way of thinking of, hey, when you think about your teams, and I think you could think about this both as a leader and like from a higher level, a grander organizational level, really thinking about what are alternative, I think, career paths and performance rewards that aren't based on title, or just moving up the corporate ladder, which is so traditional.
Exactly. Yeah. And in a way, so management is basically generalization, and you need to enable other people to follow the path of specialization and also achieve different levels in that and pay them accordingly.
I want to ask you a quick question. You said self-organizing teams. Will you talk to me a little bit about, I guess, I'm in my head, I'm thinking that sounds amazing. And I bet if it's new to you, I bet there's a hurdle in the beginning where you have to get through that doesn't quite work. People aren't sure how to manage themselves. How do you go from kind of that traditional to more self-organizing the way you just talked about it?
Well, depending on the level of experience people have, step by step, I suppose. So to give some examples, my teams are to a large extent self-organizing. I just tell them what my vision is for a new product line, and then I let them figure it out, how to make that happen, how to reach out to customers, how to answer their questions, how to build the product, et cetera, et cetera. They're smart people. Every now and then they have a question for me. And then I offer them some explanation of what my vision is. But I don't want to discuss with them exactly what needs to be on what web page and exactly what the payment structures need to be for customers and things like that. So questions plenty that they have for me, but often actually I bounce the questions back and tell them, hey, you can ask that to your fellow team members, not to me, because I'm not the best person to answer that question. And this is something that some people need to get used to, but they get used to it surprisingly quickly, really. Kids are self-organizing. They don't need instructions from parents how to play with each other and how to have fun and how to achieve results in terms of building a tree hut or whatever. They might have some questions on how to do some things. Right. But if they're given a vision, they can work it out with each other if they're sufficiently motivated. And that is what the Agile community is all about, to have self-organizing teams make their own decisions based on a vision set by management and let them, they're professionals, they're paid to be able to work out the details. And it's not only in Agile, you see the same in famous stories from the military with self-organizing squads, etc. Right. It happens everywhere. It's the way to manage in the 21st century.
You know, it's interesting that there's this great book called Startup Nation about Israel. I don't know if you've ever read it. And it talks about one of the reasons they're so innovative as a country overall is because of first of all, everybody goes in the military. But second, the military is very nimble and autonomous, meaning at every level, the self-teams are self-organizing in a lot of ways, to use your language. Because they have to be. They can't have that moving up the hierarchy, right, in the situations that they deal with. So exactly. It's interesting to hear you talk about that, because that's part of the, in this research that was done, part of the reason why as a country, they tend to produce more innovative ideas, solutions, is partially because of the self-organizing. Because I think it builds collaboration in a way that you don't get in the silos.
Yeah, true, exactly.
So one of the things you talk about is continuous innovation, like moving from just agile and lean, I shouldn't say just because they're big, but to continuous innovation. What does that mean and why the difference?
Well, I noticed, of course, I've been working in the Agile community for 10 years, and there's a lot of work to do in order to help companies be more agile. Business agility is all the rage nowadays. But for me, it is not the goal for an organization to be more agile. I define that as being able to respond to change. Yeah. That is one of the four principles in the famous Agile Manifesto, is responding to change. If you ask people to define business agility, they usually come up with a certain form of being responsive to change. Well, I think even better is being able to drive the change, to be the one that actually introduces the change in the economy, in the ecosystem, to improve lives for others, so for people, so that others have to respond to that change. And that is what innovation is all about. And if you look at the fundamental purpose for organizations, which are just another form of a complex adaptive system, as scientists would call them, is just surviving. It's surviving and thriving in an environment that is continuously changing. And the only way to keep surviving and thriving as an organization is to keep up by introducing new products, new services on a continuous basis. And we call that continuous innovation. Now, in order to be able to be that, to do that continuous innovation, you will have to be agile and lean. There's no doubt about it. Otherwise, you can't pull it off for long. I'm pretty sure about that. But I think the goal is better described for organization as surviving and thriving through continuous innovation and not business agility, because that's, in essence, is just responding to the change that you are confronted with. And sometimes you would like to be the one who introduces the change with a new product or service. Let other people respond to that.
Yeah, it's it is amazing how too when you're constantly responding, you never catch up. There's never a moment where you go, ah, nailed it. I'm now ahead of the game. You're always catching up.
Exactly, exactly. And sometimes you would like to be the first one to cross the finish line. Right?
That's right. And frankly, it's exhausting. I think it's exhausting mentally and emotionally. I think for a culture and an organization, when you're constantly playing catch up, it's like you're constantly putting out fires. I think turnover goes up, engagement goes down. It's exhausting.
Yes. And also, if you're only responding to change, you basically allow others to set the direction of the business, of the industry that you're in. And maybe you have a different idea about the vision, about the direction that everyone should be moving in. Maybe you have a 90% or a tangent that you think is more interesting as a direction. And you go there and maybe you're right. And then everyone has to follow because they were right. Going in the wrong direction. So that is continuous innovation, too.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. So I'm just going to throw out an example for a second to kind of bring it to real world. You know, Tough Mudder, the extreme sports, they were the first ones to do the whole team-based extreme sport, you know, military-style obstacle courses, 12, 50 miles. And everything else was individual-based at the time. Marathons, triathlons, not that those aren't hard. So don't get me wrong. I'm not knocking anyone who does those because, oh, my God. But they were the first to take the industry in a different place. And then everybody scrambled to catch up and create their own version of this kind of new team camaraderie thing that had extreme sport that had popped up. And it was interesting to see the shift. And now we take it for granted because the industry existed. But somebody had to do it first. And you're so right, what you just said. And I hope all of us listening are really paying attention. They set the tone for what that industry looks like. And everybody else followed them.
Yeah, exactly. That's a nice example. Another example is the games industry, where since a year, everyone is talking about Fortnite. My own kids are playing Fortnite.
Get me started. I have two boys.
And the creators of Fortnite, they were not just responding to change. They created a change that the entire industry has now been scrambling to catch up to. So sometimes you'd like to be that one.
Right. Okay, so I want to talk about your book that you just came out. So this is the second one we've had you on for, because your work is so, so good and has such a huge impact for your clients. I love the title of this one. It's Startup, Scale Up, Screw Up. So what I wanted to do with you is actually break those three things down in order, what you mean by them and why they're important. Because when I saw the title of the book, you can imagine, I'm sure other people just do, I was like, screw up? Like, wait, what? Don't you mean success up or something? I don't know. So let's start with startup and work our way through. So break them down for us.
So, yeah, sure. Of course, the title gets people curious. That's the intention of the title.
Obviously. Good marketing.
And though I had a disagreement with my publisher about it, but we could talk about that another time. startup is, what's the startup ecosystem in Silicon Valley and other hubs in the world are all about is a new idea that is unproven that you're trying to figure out if there's a market for it, if there's product market fit, as they call it in startup language. They are in the life cycle of a product or service. They are the kid years until being a teenager, basically, until the entire business model is validated and you have revenue streams, you've validated having customers, the right channels to sell the product and service, the right people to make the product, etc. And then once you have validated everything seems to work, then you can start scaling up, and then we call it a scale up. From that moment, you switch basically from exploration to execution. You have validated the business model. Now you just want to sell 1,000 times more of the same thing. And then you switch to optimization, basically, also because by that time, probably competitors have figured out that you discovered this new gold seam in the mountains, and others are scrambling to get there as well. And they can skip all the startup stage, basically, but you did all the hard work. So now you have to switch to optimization. You fight territory and have to create a business that can fend off competitors. And then this the screw up part, well, that can happen at any time. I mean, any business, any new idea can die at any moment when you fail to validate that there's a need for it, or your team doesn't work, or whatever. So it can basically can die at any moment. And I have heard or read the ratio of for every 50 ideas that people have, business ideas, only one ultimately becomes profitable, and the rest basically die before that time. So that's a very small percentage of successful companies that remains. So by that time, you're a scale up. Otherwise, you have screwed up before that time. But then even when you have a successful business, no company, no business model lives forever. So you need to prepare for that. There will be an end, like the iPod has recently died. It was replaced by the iPhone. Now the iPhone is in a midlife crisis. I don't think it will. It has many years left as the business model that it has now, and so things have to change all the time and have to be replaced with new business models. Microsoft did this in time with their Microsoft Office suite, right? It was sold per edition, where you bought a new version, and now people have subscriptions to those software packages, which is a different business model that they had to launch and experiment with first. So every business model begins, scales up, hopefully, and then at some point dies. And that is normal. That is the normal life cycle of a product or service. This could play out in a matter of months, like in the gaming industry, or it could take decades or maybe even a few hundred years for a business model to die. But dying it will at some point. And the company has to prepare for that by always coming up with new ideas, with new family members, basically, in the family of products and services.
So I want to back up and ask you questions in each of them that I was just writing down. So one is from the startup phase. This really applies, right? Not just if you're like an entrepreneur, you know, with some funding, but also if you're inside a company and you're trying to build a new product or service that the company should launch, right?
Exactly,
so, and is there a difference in how you think about that if you are, you know, team A versus, you know, an entrepreneur or company?
No, I think it's a very good question. And actually, it is my message to corporates, enterprises, that they should behave more like a startup ecosystem, like an innovation funnel. Because the mistake that many make is that they try to predict which of the 50 ideas is going to be that success. And nobody can make that prediction. It is impossible to predict which of 50 ideas is going to be the profitable one. So the solution to that is to embrace all ideas and start testing all of them, and then have them move through what we call the innovation funnel. And then you will see that one by one, the ideas will die off because they are unable to find problem solution fits. They're unable to find product market fits. And the further they get, the bigger the budgets get, because this is also how investors work with external startup. First, the founders fund the first couple of months, and then they find angel investors with a big, somewhat bigger budgets. And then if they made more progress and have collected more evidence, then hopefully they find venture capitalists, and et cetera, et cetera. So stage by stage, the further they get, the bigger the budgets. And this should be mimicked, I think, in organizations where you allow all the ideas to start, and then after every stage, you invest bigger budgets in the ideas that are still remaining. And then at one point, you have one winner out of the 50 based on pure evidence of the performance.
So now I want to ask you about the scale-up phase. One of the things that you said that really caught my attention, and you said it quickly, but so I want to go back to it, is that's also the phase where competitors come in. And I think oftentimes we think of scale-up, I know I certainly have, as that's where you're growing and dominating. Like, woo, look at us, we're scaling up. But when you said that, I thought to myself, oh, what a great point. It really made me realize I need to keep innovating. I can't just, you know, make minor tweaks. And sometimes a small tweak can be a huge innovation, but you know what I mean? Like, I can't just rest on the fact that I got it right and now I'm just about growing. that I really have to pay attention to the competition going in. So, I mean, is that part of what happens at that phase too? Is the, hey, it seems to me that's where innovation often drops off, because suddenly we go, oh, we're good. We're past the startup phase. We got the idea right. Now we're just growing.
Yeah, sure. So it is called the difference between disruptive innovation versus sustaining innovation. The startup years are about disruptive innovation. You try to come up with something new that did not exist before, and that's going to change the industry somehow a bit. But then when you found something, you can't stop, because others will try to catch up and try to improve on your offer. So you have to keep improving. And then we call it sustaining innovation. And just to give one example, I am now here in Washington, D.C., but I see the same thing in my hometown in Brussels, Belgium. There were these scooters that people now use since a year or so to move themselves around. Well, first I saw one, and then within months, three or four competitors emerged. And they all look the same. They all have four-letter brand names for some reason.
That's all the rage. It's like the Z at the end of every band in the 90s. Now it's four letters.
Exactly. So I don't know what the difference is. So just imagine how hard it is for the ones leading those companies to just differentiate themselves from the others, because now it is already a commodity, and they're still in this scaling stage, and they're already have to fend off 5 or 10 competitors in some of these. So that's hard. And scaling is the teenage years of a business model, base where everything changes when you switch from being a kid to being an adult, playing by the rules of the adults. And fending off your competition, and then after that, the next stage would be crystallization, as I call it. And you are one of the winners in the industry, and then you make so much money that you'll have to invest in the younger generation. Then it is time to make babies, and new products and services, because then you have the money to actually do that.
So you know, it's reminding me of, so I live in Denver, and we started with rental bike stations, these red bikes all over town, but they're stations. You put in your credit card. I think they have them in DC too, on the mall. So you put in your credit card, you rent your bike for a couple hours, and then you drop it off. So it doesn't matter where you drop it off, but some other station. And that was, when that came out, that was totally groundbreaking. You know, this idea of like rent a bike, you know, and then we moved to these free bikes, and now there's bikes and scooters, and people just drop them off on random street corners. I can never understand if like it ran out of battery, or you're just like, I'm done. I'm done on the street corner. But to your point, the rental bike almost faded out fast and led the path for everything being free. I mean, it's just fascinating to see what you're talking about and all the competition that came in a really couple year period of time. It wasn't that fast.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
That slow.
Indeed, as you said, the bike stations with the fixed locations, that's a thing of the past already, and that was a business model that's just a few years old, and it's already dying, because something else came up, which is more flexible for customers.
Yeah, it paved the way, but it wasn't going to last. I want to ask you about the screw up phase too, and this is more of a personal question, or maybe a personal challenge. One of the things in my experience that I've discovered is that, you know, what's beautiful about people is that we're very passionate. And when we, you know, when an idea has a champion inside an organization, it's going to move further. Someone who really wants to drive it. And that's fantastic. The flip side to that is sometimes, you know, it becomes their baby. And, you know, you had said a couple minutes ago that, you know, if you have 50 ideas, you don't get to decide in the conference room which ones are going to make you money, which ones aren't. And I 100% agree with you, right? That's false data. It's, you can't know until someone is will open up their wallets or not, if it's a good idea. But how do you move people when you've got, let's say you put this 50 out there, right? You've got two winners. How do you move people through the emotional side of almost detaching yourself from the ideas? To really test what's right and really own those results. And I know that that's kind of more of an emotional question, but I do think that's a challenge for a lot of us, particularly when we're trying to be innovative inside our companies, because we do get very attached to the ideas that we create or have heart for, and that's a beautiful thing, but it can also get in the way.
Yeah, actually, it's funny because exactly the same question was asked to me yesterday night. It's a very very valid question.
And I'm not the first person to ask it.
No. Sorry, Tamara. But probably because it's a great question. As I said, the great innovations happen multiple times at
That's
the
right.
same.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Great questions emerge as well. I often draw the analogy with TV programs such as X Factor or Voice of America or whatever, where you have lots of candidates starting in the first stage, and then stage by stage, more and more drop off until you have the best ones remaining. And of course, each candidate thinks that they are better than most of the others. They have to be, but if you do not have that passion, if you're not convinced of your own abilities, you won't start at all. It's the same for startups. All of them have this wildly exaggerated sense of accomplishment, because if they weren't delusional, they wouldn't start in the first place. So it is this interesting paradox of people have to believe in their own capabilities, otherwise they won't even start, with this really, really bad survival ratio of only 1 out of 50 or 1 out of 20, depending on the context. And it is the same in organizations. So you need to teach people, on the one hand, that only a few will remain. You have to show them that the process is going to be as fair as possible. At the same time, you have to allow them to believe that they will be the ones who are going to win. Because if they're not going to believe that, nobody's going to start.
Right.
And yeah, that's life. I cannot make it any better than that.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers do really show for themselves, but I think it is hard because we do have a lot of passion. And to your point, you have to go in. You wouldn't put 50 random ideas forward. You would pick the ones that you think, based on what you know, are the right ones to move forward. It's not haphazard in what you try to experiment and test with.
Right.
How do you think about, and this is a little bit from a cultural perspective too, an individual perspective, how do you think about continuing to drive innovation as you move through those phases and not letting it drop off? You know, at each phase has its own little rubber meets the road kind of area.
Do you mean from a founder's perspective or from the perspective of the ones managing that funnel?
The ones managing the funnel.
Well, I think there are two important roles. I compare it a little bit to teaching people how to drive. You have the ones who are drivers instructors, and you have the ones who are the testers to see if people pass the test. And they should be different people, because otherwise you have a conflict of interest. So I think the same should be in organizations, where you have the coaches and the mentors helping the internal startup founders with their ideas and teaching them the lean startup way and design thinking and agile and lean and all that stuff that they are going to need of rapid experimentation, etc. And then also you need the innovation board, who are going to be like the jury, who decide whether or not an idea has passed the test, whether they have collected enough evidence to move on to the next stage. And they will need to have definitions of done and data on the markets that the startups are addressing. And there are plenty of practices that companies use, such as hackathons for people to come up with the first ideas in the first stage. There's internal crowdfunding, where you use the crowd in the organization, the employees, to basically bet with virtual money on what they think the best ideas are. Yeah. So you tap into the wisdom of the collective crowd, basically. Adobe has a program where every employee has $1,000 package or something to develop their ideas in the first stage. Many, many, many practices are available to support and create that funnel and to help people be innovative.
I got a question for you, because this has come up in multiple calls with clients and prospective clients at Launch Street. One of the pain points that we've been hearing from clients is, hey, we implemented agile, lean, design thinking, whichever one. And they're all fantastic, I think. And some are right for some organizations and some are right for others. But the calls I'm getting are, hey, so in fact, the two this week were, hey, we implemented design thinking. We love the process. But people are just seeing it as another initiative, right? Another process that they have to follow. We're not getting the personal side of the engagement. And I think they're coming to us because of you know, we have that this assessment and the ability to tell people how they innovate, so how they contribute and how they add value to that process. But I'm curious from your perspective, if you see that at all and how you combat that when you implement these types of processes to not create that fatigue with your people.
Gosh, it sounds to me that kind of feedback like innovation has not yet become part of the DNA of an organization. In the ideal situation, anyone is allowed to start working, spend a few hours on an idea, and then have that idea tested for validity to move on to the next stage. And then when it enters the next stage, based on some criteria that the innovation committee, the jury will have to set, then they get a little bit of budget to develop that idea a bit further. And that kind of process needs to be part of the cultural DNA, as I said, of the organization, not some side program that we do maybe in a few months to see what we can come up with, and then after those few months everything is back to normal, because then it doesn't stick. Actually, I think that ultimately the entire organization should be inside the funnel. So you could start as a separate initiative where you get all new ideas entering the funnel with defined stages, one to five, as I define them in my book, but you can have any other model for all I care. But then once they finally reach the scale-up stage and become profitable, then you could say, well, we basically extend the funnel to stages 1 to 10 because they need to stay innovative. We just switch from disruptive innovation to sustaining innovation, and we keep managing those business models even when they are entered the adult life cycle stages, and they never leave the funnel basically, and the old business models will die at some point and the new ones all enter the funnel. So at one point the entire organization is in the funnel. It's one big family of ideas going through life cycle stages 1 to 10. And then if you did that, then you have made innovation part of the culture. And I think you're right when many organizations just see it as a side project that they do maybe in another department, even in another building, but the main company is not really involved in the innovative efforts. And you will never get there if you keep it at that.
Well, and I think I totally track with what you're saying. And I think too that, you know, we spend so much time focusing on the process, whatever that process is we decide to use. And again, nothing wrong with the process, but our efforts are there and not on the people that have to implement the process. And I think that's where there's a massive disconnect for a lot of people who then are the ones who are supposed to own it every day, but they weren't really considered. There was so much effort on just one side of the whole ecosystem that needs to happen.
Right. And some people told me, and I believe them completely, that the original design thinkers never had a process. They just did things. Yeah. Like empathizing with people and hypothesizing what could be useful for them, and then sensitizing whether they had an effect with their with their prototypes, and all of that was intuitive what they did. And then when they had successes, then others asked, "How did you do that?" And then they had to sort of codify what they did with a 5-step or 7-step sequential or circular process. And now those processes are being taught, but people should learn that it is not the process that gives you innovation. It is the mindset. It is ideally you would start doing this intuitively and you don't need the process anymore.
Yeah, well said about it's the mindset, without a doubt. So with that, I want to bring it to you for a minute. How do you innovate when you think about your own internal workings?
Well, I always try not to follow the regular paths to anything that I do. I always think, could this be done in a more in a different way? So to give you an example, I am now recruiting for a COO for my company. And there are standard hiring processes, but I find them boring. So I came up with different first steps. So the first step was I asked candidates to answer three questions on video and send that video to me, because recording yourself on video and having video calls is one of the most important skills for my COO, because my entire team is distributed across the world. So it is only fair that I test for that capability, that they're able to handle technologies like that. And next stage that I just completed was that they had to interview me. So not me interviewing them, I just had them interview me for 30 minutes so that I could assess what kind of questions do they ask me, what do they think will be important for them as COO. And quite quickly, I saw that some candidates I could just put them aside because I don't think they were asking the right questions. And others had brilliant questions that I didn't even think of. So I thought, well, those are the ones that definitely may go to the next stage.
Right.
And I'd completely turn things upside down, and I make the steps really dependent on the role. So I think, what do I expect from a COO? Well, I expect that a COO takes charge for me on my behalf. That person should be my number one. So I'm not going to tell the CEO what the process is. Basically, I'm going to let that person, the candidate, take charge of the recruitment process. Because if that person is able to do that, then he would be a great candidate. So, and that's innovation in the hiring process. I just ignore the standard processes and come up with something that makes sense to me, given this context. And the candidate loved it.
Well, don't you find too that oftentimes the rules were just other people's ways of doing things, and then we adopt them, and they don't actually work for us. The process might be fine, but it doesn't actually work for us.
Yeah, and well, there is a reason why you have good practices, or some would call them best practices, because they work reasonably well in many cases. And if you follow them, then well, definitely you will not have a bad hiring process. But you could, with a little bit of thinking, you could improve significantly for your specific context, for a specific role. Like, there are certain talents that I want to see in a COO, so I just embed them in the first couple of stages of the process and completely turn things around. And the candidates love it, and it gave me less work to do because I didn't have to prepare for the interviews.
Right. Even better. I like that. Yeah. Well, and to your point, if you want someone that's going to take charge, they should come in prepared.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Where can people go to learn more, connect, get the book?
Well, the book you can find on startup-scaleup-screwup.com. It's a long URL, so you can also just go to my own website, jurgenappelo.com. I'm sure you will add the link to the footnotes.
Yes.
And I'm on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn, you name it, all the socials. I'm pretty active everywhere. So happy to answer any questions if people have them.
All right. This has been fantastic. What's the last question for you? Is what's one piece of advice you have for innovators out there that are trying to continuously innovate and start up, scale up, screw up?
Make your screw up survivable. So that is what we teach in the Agile community: to fail fast, fail small, do things iteratively, so that if things don't work, at least you still have the ability to stand up and say, well, I learned something. Let's try something else. So make sure the screw-ups don't kill you, because only then you will make it until the very, very end as a business model that has lived a lovely long life cycle. And I wish everyone to have their screw-up at the very, very end.
You know, me too. I also think that's why experimentation along the way is so important, because I think one of the mistakes that I see a lot of teams do is you go from conference room to launch and all the validation is hypothetical versus tiny little tests. They don't have to be fancy or perfect. They just need to be little tests along the way to validate and recognize where you have gaps before you go to real launch.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Jürgen, thank you so much for coming by again, and good luck on your U.S. whirlwind tour. And we'll talk, you know, the next time you've got something for us.
Thank you so much, Tamara. Happy to come back in a year or two.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.